Hi, everybody, and welcome to the Cultural Studies podcast. My name is Toby Miller, and my guest today is
Stacey Sowers, and I'm a professor in the Moody College of Communication at the University of Texas at Austin.
a great and justly famous university and school of communication. So lovely to have you here. Thank you so much for joining us, Profess. It's deeply
Thank you for
appreciated,
having me.
even by the podcat who tried to sabotage it. And who's now come out to observe his world. First question, Prof, if I may, is to ask you what's currently interesting, jazzing, worrying, preoccupying, dynamizing you?
Well, there's a number of directions I could go in, but I think I'll start by an event that I just came from, and that's to think about the political environment in the state of Texas and how that's affecting us in academia in the state of Texas, but also more broadly for citizens of the state of Texas in terms of working towards tenure changes and bans on critical race theory and moving in the direction of banning diversity, equity, and inclusion programs and positions. And so that's been on my mind, as one example. And then in a completely different direction, I have an 8-year-old daughter who's in third grade. And so I think a lot about her schooling and what she's learning. And in some ways, that is kind of related because of the ban on critical race theory and in K through 12th grades here in Texas. So there's a lot to be thinking about in and how those overlap and relate to each other.
Snap, I too have an 8-year-old daughter and a 3-month-old granddaughter, actually. So, yes, I get that. And so, this is a citizen worry, it's a faculty worry, it's a mom worry. Right? Yeah.
Yeah, yep, that's right.
And they intersect, of course, in very powerful ways. And it's been interesting that some young very young, I should say, not to say you're not young, but very young faculty that I've been talking to in Hong Kong and in, shall we say, certain American states have requested that I not talk to them about anything political for fear of their careers.
Yeah, I'm not too worried because I'm a tenured full professor, so I'm a little bit protected still, and I feel like it's important to be brave and talk about these things. So I'm happy to chat about
For
the
sure.
politics
Well,
in the
could
US and in Texas.
if
But
we
I
go
understand why people are fearful.
back, 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 as they say in baseball parlance, to the expression "don't mess with Texas," that started out as an environmental catch cry, right?
Yeah, that's right.
And there have always been very progressive forces in Texas. And in fact, Democratic governors in the post-civil rights era. So what's gone wrong?
Well, it seems that Texas is just one of many states who are moving towards kind of a far right wing conservative turn. And so that's not just happening here in Texas. It's in Florida and Alabama and other southern states, particularly the southern states, but also Nebraska and Utah. And so it's this conservative right-wing shift. I just came from this panel in which the speaker was talking about how a bunch of conservative think tanks are funding a lot of these movements in the different states. And so the speaker was saying that it makes it look like that there's a lot of outcry and public support for the banning of books or banning of critical race theory. But in fact, it's probably just mostly the way in which these think tanks have organized and galvanized political support for their positions. And it's about a few active people pushing for those agendas, but not necessarily reflective of the general public. And so I think that that shift in Texas and a lot of other states is really hard to deal with as an everyday citizen.
I mean, the public opinion polls on views of critical race theory tend to show that people don't have a clear idea what it is, and neither object to it nor endorse it, majority, and that lots of people, when asked, do you think it's important to understand race in studying the history of the United States, say yes.
Yeah, that's right. A lot of people misunderstand critical race theory. I mean, as you probably know, and as I know, that it originated in legal studies as a way to talk about how court decisions and other ways in which the law functions to police and legislate and control race. And so in critical race theories in the law, those studies have been really important in moving and thinking about how the law functions to police and racialize people. And all, you know, a lot of, say, communication scholars have picked up different aspects of critical race theory and used it to talk about how that functions in other spheres, other realms. But you know, it's not just that K through 12 grades are talking or teaching about critical race theory in that very specific way.
And I, oh, sorry, I thought I'd pushed the silence button. I'm not having my most professional moment with you in this conversation, for which my sincere apologies. He turned the television on again, and then he threatened to interrupt the router, which would have stopped our conversation. So I've been doing some vaguely techie things.
It's macrobatics.
When you describe the K through 12 issue, again, this is very misleading when critical race theory, as you say, began in Columbia University and other major studies, centers of legal studies, and has really been important in the social sciences and the humanities. But very few people have tried to take it anywhere in schools apart from these crazies in state legislatures seeking to ban something that wasn't really there. And yet, people who simply talked about race in history have lost their jobs as high school history teachers. So.
Yeah, so I think that that's really complicated because I think the effect of such laws means that teachers don't know what to do in the classroom. So if you're
Yes.
thinking about history, let's just take the Civil War as one example. How do you not talk about race in the context of the Civil War? And so what are teachers supposed to do, even in elementary schools? Like, how do you talk about the Civil War or civil rights leaders without being able to talk about race? And then you think about middle school and high school history courses or social studies, and it gets really complicated. And then we see that happening in the higher education realm. And so when people become afraid of what they're doing, they start to police themselves. And you can see that happening in higher education. And in Florida and Texas, there have been people who've said that they're a little bit fearful that if they talk about race issues in the classroom, that that they'll get fired or they're in precarious positions and you know they're worried about losing their jobs. So maybe they police themselves, self-police themselves or not, but the you know th that fear that's there is really troubling. And I think it's moving in the direction of self-censorship, but also just the pressure from not just the state, but also administration and our legal offices who are also fearful of what's of repercussions that might come about. And so it's a strange time to live in the state of Texas and some of these other states that have passed such legislation.
Sure. In terms of your own work, if we could move on to that for a moment, your published work. As I mentioned to you before we started recording, it covers a vast amount of terrain and I think has had profound effects in a number of different areas: rhetoric, philosophy, feminism, the media, environment, just to name a few, and sometimes those things have intersected in your work. When you went for your job interview at Austin, unless it was just given to you by the grace of animals, what did you say you did?
Well, I think I've always defined my work as residing in the intersections of race and nationality and gender and environment. And so, my book about Dolores Huerta and the United Farm Workers, for example,
Yes.
is an examination of those intersections and how one navigates, race and gender and then how that relates to environmental issues, agricultural issues, workers' rights in the civil rights movement. And so I think that's one example of how my work does that. Sometimes it will maybe lose one of those pieces if I'm working with a co-author who has slightly different interests, but I like to work with, I really, really like to write with and research with other
Others.
scholars because it's collaborative and I really enjoy that process. And you get so much insight from working with others. And so sometimes that work might focus more on a gender aspect or an environmental aspect.
And Prof,
That's kind of how I see my work.
thank you. You've passed. You get the job. Everything's fine. In all seriousness, now, although the plurality of our listeners is in the United States, the majority is not. So, for those folks, could you fill us in a little bit on that book on Dolores Huerta and the campaigns?
Yeah, sure. So Dolores Huerta was
Would
born
you
in
welcome?
1930, and she's I think she's turning 94 in April of this year. And as she wasn't super well known for her work with the United Farm Workers. Cesar Chavez is much more well known both nationally and internationally in the US, but they co-founded the United Farm Workers Union together in the 60s and were advocating for farm workers' rights. There are lots of different issues around farm workers' rights in the United States, but a lot of the workers were immigrants from Mexico or the Philippines or other parts of the world. And so it in some ways is an international issue too because of the sheer vast expanse of workers coming from all of these different places in the 20th. The 19th and 20th centuries. And so they worked to ban the short-handled hoe so that people wouldn't have to bend over so much. And when they're hoeing in the fields, they tried to work on banning or restricting different kinds of pesticides. They got drinking water and bathroom access in the fields. So those are just a few of the accomplishments. But my book looks at how Dolores Huerta was an effective leader and how she navigated both gender and race and the civil rights movement in the broader context of what was going on in the United States in the 1960s and 70s. And so it's looking at what the UFW did, but also how she was able to participate in that movement. I didn't mention that she also had 11 children, so she was trying to negotiate her role as a mother to these kids and then also working in the union.
Now, another factor in your work, which is insufficiently normal or typical in US communication studies, is its very generous and profound internationalism. And you've worked in and about different parts of the world and learned languages from different parts of the world. Could you share with us a little bit of that experience and what impelled you to reach out in ways that common or garden communications often fails to do?
I've always had a very strong interest in travel and understanding other parts of the world. I can think back to my time in middle school and high school and my interest in wanting to know a lot more about the rest of the world. But let's see, when I was in college, I did a Mexican studies minor and I had studied in Mexico for a semester. And right after I came back from that, my parents, I grew up in this little small town in rural Colorado, a coal mining town that was about 4 hours from Denver. So it's pretty isolated. And there weren't a lot of opportunities for what I just described, this international interest that I had. But when I came back from this Mexico study program, my parents told me that they were going to move to Indonesia. And so my junior year in college, they moved to Indonesia and I started going there to visit them. And then I had gone to graduate school right after I finished my undergraduate degree. So I was visiting my parents a lot and thinking about intercultural communication and global international communication. And that's kind of what started my path and the kind of work that I did in Indonesia. It was a lot, really all of it was focused on environmental issues in Indonesia and thinking about how we talk about environmental issues to different kinds of audiences, different groups of people. So my dissertation was about organizations working to protect orangutans in Indonesia. And then that led to I got a Fulbright scholarship. So then I did my doctoral work on those organizations in Indonesia. And then I had another Fulbright in 2005. And then we started this when I was at the University of Texas at El Paso. We started a partnership with the nonprofit organization RARE. And through that program, I was coordinating our Indonesia classes and doing work with RARE in Indonesia. So that was an 11 or 12 year partnership. And we also had the programs in Mozambique and Brazil and Micronesia and Colombia. And so those were some other places that I visited to better understand how environmental campaigns work in really small scale efforts in rural or local communities and how you can create behavior change in communities through these campaigns by training campaign managers. And so that was really exciting work, but I got to travel all over the world essentially for that work. And it has really shaped the way that I understand and think about environmental issues, but also lots of other things too.
Because one of the questions that's confronting environmental movements at present is the notion of environmental colonialism and a certain tendency on the part of do-gooders to take over the worlds of others. And I imagine that part of your travel was to become aware of those sorts of issues before a lot of us were.
Yeah, definitely. So one of the things I really liked about the RARE program is that it was sort of a that th this program was and how would I describe it? So my role was to work with Indonesian our partners in Indonesia who work at RARE in the city of Bogor. And they were the instructors for this program. So I worked with them to ensure that our curriculum matched what we said that we were going to be teaching. And so we tried to focus on leadership, research methods, conservation, knowledge, and social marketing skills. So those four areas. And through what I learned from that is the So how it works is that they recruit people from rural or local communities throughout Indonesia, and then they come to these training programs that are sometimes 12 weeks long, sometimes 3 weeks long. And they learn how they learn those kinds of skills to take back to their communities. And I found that that was such a much better approach than me trying to go into those communities to understand the environmental issues. Because it can take years, if not our entire lifetimes, to understand the issues, say, facing subsistence fishers or subsistence farmers. And so how can we really do that if we live in, say, the United States? And how can we understand conservation issues if we're not there all the time? And so I think this program was really helpful in training people to actually do that work in their own communities instead of having parachute scientists or parachute conservationists.
Moving on to some of your gender work, there's a fairly recent article that I read that you co-authored that invokes the concept of reproductive justice. And this is the question of justice is one of the things that you've looked at in different ways in different work. I wonder if you could talk to us a wee bit about reproductive justice and that new article.
Sure. So my colleague Raelynn Schwartz-Dupree, who's at Western Washington University, she and I have been writing a little bit together on reproductive justice, and it kind of started with a project, a book chapter that we wrote on the donor sperm and donor egg industries, and then how children's books are written to describe their relationship to the donor, I guess. And in part, that was because both Raylan and I had undergone in vitro fertilization processes. And so we're thinking through how we talk to our own kids about that and what it means to them. And then starting to think a little bit about what this means in the broader context of, say, reproductive justice. And the most recent piece that we just finished and submitted for review is about how personhood in frozen embryos is defined. And so we've been working on this project for the past year. And then last month in the state of Alabama, the state Supreme Court said that frozen embryos can be considered as persons. And so that could change everything about the in vitro fertilization industry. So we're kind of thinking through and teasing out how reproductive justice can provide a lens or a framework for understanding these complex issues and how people want to use in vitro fertilization as a way to have children and what that means for people who are experiencing infertility, but also what does that mean for queer folks who want to have children who might not be experiencing infertility but don't have another option to have children if they wanted to have children. So we're looking at it from a bunch of different perspectives, and but a lot of that's just based on our personal experience and reading widely in the literature and knowing what we both went through in order to have our own children.
Thanks for sharing that with us. I wonder if you could tease out a bit more for us the concept of reproductive justice more generally in feminist communities.
So I think that the pro-life and the pro-choice movements have framed abortion, for example, in a very particular way, that you either have the right to choose or that we should protect life. And so reproductive justice offers us maybe an alternative to both of those dichotomous ways of thinking. And that is the framework for reproductive justice is that we should have the right to have children or not to have children, and that we should have the right to pursue reproduction in a way that makes sense for our own bodies. It's rooted in Black women's experiences. So Loretta Ross is one of the main writers in the area of reproductive justice and writing about Black women's experiences and how. I think it's really important to highlight that because Black women have higher infertility rates and less access to medical care. And so reproductive justice is really designed to help us think through some of these issues as maybe an alternative to the pro-choice, pro-life dichotomy.
And moving on, Prof, to go back to environmental questions, there is now a thriving field that you're a leading figure in, environmental communication. What are its limits? What does it do? What does it not do? What should it do?
That's a big question. I think there's been some interesting conversations in the field about defining environmental communication as a crisis discipline. So that set of conversations goes back maybe 15 or maybe even 20 years. And I think that that's a really interesting way of thinking about environmental issues that we address environmentalism, environmental communication, when it becomes a crisis, that when we're thinking about natural disasters, for example, it's a disaster, it's a crisis, and or that species are extinct or becoming extinct, or that rainforests are being cut down, or coral reefs are bleaching. And so it's being defined by those crises. But more recently, the new editor of the journal Environmental Communication, Phaedra Pizzullo, is thinking through environmental communication as a discipline of care. And so in her first two issues of 2024, the focus is on how we can define environmental communication as a discipline of care. And I wrote a piece for that about how those campaigns that I was describing earlier create these communities of care through the way in which they, it's not just that they go out and implement a conservation campaign, it's that they're trying to engage the communities through all of these different ways, whether it's in schools or through fun contests or cooking classes or involving people in the process. And so it's very participatory and it's about caring for the community. And so I think that that's a really interesting way of reframing environmental communication so that it's not just always about the crisis, but it could also be about how we care about our communities and other people. And then I think something else that is I've seen this, these kinds of discussions happening, not so much in environmental communication, but thinking about how there's so much focus on climate change, and that's where a lot of the research funding is, and that when we put everything into climate change, then we're also missing some of the other environmental issues that may or may not be directly connected to climate change. And so thinking beyond climate change, I think, has got to be part of those conversations too.
That's interesting. So, where would animal studies fit in there? What does it fit in? Animal rights issues, animal
Yeah,
justice issues?
I mean, I think that animals are a very connective piece. So, my own dissertation looks at how orangutans, for example, are ways that people feel connected to an environmental issue. So you'll hear a lot of people say, "Oh, I just really love koala bears," right? Really love orangutans or elephants or giraffe, whatever. But they get connected to an animal, which helps them to care more about the broader environment. There's a cute kids show about koala bears that my daughter's been watching, and I think it's just a way that. That when you care about, say, a koala bear, you're also caring about the koala bear's habitat or the orangutan's habitat or the elephant's habitat or whatever it might be. So animals in that sense can be very connective for us. But then we also have our cats and our dogs and our hamsters and our, pet snakes or whatever it is. And so we feel connected to animals in these other ways too. And so I think it's a way in which we can continue to express that element of care.
In terms of some of the radical approaches to environment, I'm thinking of political economy or socialist environmentalism and ecofeminism. How significant are they in environmental communication as a discipline or as a set of approaches?
I think in rhetorical studies, there's a lot of people who are engaging in kind of critical discourses about environmental activism or movements or whatever it might be. I think more broadly, thinking a little bit about how those can be effective or ineffective is really helpful. So if you're too radical, maybe that alienates audiences. So if you take people for the ethical treatment of animals, PETA, a lot of people, we talk about them in my environmental communication class. So a lot of students find their tactics off-putting, and it has that sort of boomerang effect where it's alienating people instead of drawing them into a cause. I know that PETA for myself is pretty helpful in thinking about animal issues. But I know that that doesn't always work for all audiences. And so thinking about these different ways in which we engage people is really important. I
That's
don't know if
interesting.
I answered that your question.
No, I think the example of Peter is a good one. No, I'm wondering about, I guess in a way you did, in another way you didn't, but I'm not sure the question was very well phrased on my part. So I guess I think of ecofeminism and socialist environmentalism or eco-socialism as powerful, significant critiques of everyday human sciences as applied to our environmental crises. And at one level, there's the activist element, as you say, like Peter, which itself involves theories and analyses about gender and media effects and so on. And on the other hand, there's these things as analytic foci that enable one to think differently, to think about the role of hegemonic masculinity in along cultivating, if that's the right word, our environmental catastrophe, or the role of industrial capitalism and state socialism in cultivating our own environmental disaster. You know what I mean? So there's
Yeah.
those both, in a sense, personal but also very macro forms of critique that I think are very powerful. And I'm just not, it's not clear to me what kind of role they really have in environmental communication. They're big in environmental philosophy, they're big in environmental sociology, but I'm unclear as to what they mean for environmental communication.
I think that there are, and then this is where I started to go. There are a number of rhetorical studies scholars who do engage in those works, like Phaedra Pasulo, for example, and Catalina Deonis and others who are looking at like how, for example, with ecofeminism, how race and gender become relevant or are always a part of engaging with our environments. And so there are scholars who are doing that kind of work. And I'm thinking about there's a book called Racial Ecologies that really does a great job of looking at these kinds of intersections with how racial identities are so intricately connected with environmental issues, and gender is a part of that too. And so, and then how settler colonialism and imperialism are also working in those directions, and what do those mean? We just read a great book in my class, Empire's Tracks, and it's about the railroad industry in 19th century United States, but it also talks about railroads all over the planet and how railroads have shaped so much of our landscapes and our cultures, and it's really fascinating look at those histories, right?
And
So I
when
think
you're
there's some of that good critical work.
great, thank you. Thank you for sharing that with us. When you're chatting with your students about this, be they undergrad or grad, what sorts of reactions are you getting when you're talking about reproductive justice, or you're talking about ecofeminism or environmental colonialism?
I think pretty positive reactions. I think our students are really wanting to understand the worlds that they are entering into. So our graduate students are really hungry for that kind of critical scholarship. The undergrads, it's interesting because in my environmental communication class, I have a lot of students who are some kind of science major or maybe engineering. Or maybe like some of my students are taking the MCAT today, the medical entrance exam. And so what they're really looking for are like trying to understand the world in a different way than through their science degrees. And so I think they're really hungry for this kind of knowledge and information and thinking about how important conservation and addressing climate change is. It's an important subject for a lot of the students.
And Prof, I've got two more questions for you, if I may, and then I'd like to throw it to you to add anything you want to our conversation. Does that sound all right as a way of
Sure.
proceeding?
Sure.
So my first question is to ask you what's next for you in research terms.
Well, I have a project that I want to do about the civil rights activist Ruben Salazar, who was a Mexican American journalist. He was killed in 1970. So I might take up that project in the next few weeks. We'll see if I can make time for it. So that's one big project, but I think more broadly, I'm really thinking about joy and how I think coming out of the COVID-19 pandemic, there are so many people who have this sense of dread, a sense of everything's wrong in the world, and it's hard. So I'm really thinking about joy and how we can engage in more joy in our lives and all of the parts of our lives. So I think one of the things that happens with a lot of our critical work, our protest work, is that it's heavy and we're trying to address really important topics, and it can feel like nothing's going to change. We can look at the situation in Gaza as one example. So how can we bring joy and connectivity and community in our protests or in our writing or in our research and making time to spend with other people in community. So that's really what I'm thinking a lot about these days.
Wonderful, wonderful. So my last question before handing over to you to conclude with whatever it is you want to add, as I said, is to ask you if you would share with us your ways in which you find stuff out. How do you find out the things that you write about? You've already said it's a bit different when you're co-authoring with somebody, when you're writing with somebody. So perhaps you could also address that.
I'd say a big part of many of my research projects starts from some personal experience. I mentioned the in vitro fertilization. That was a personal experience. Thinking about environmental issues in Indonesia, that started out as a personal experience. And I think having that personal experience makes me want to know more. And so that's when, maybe the research part of things kicks in. And I think, like the Ruben Salazar project that I just mentioned, one of the reasons I know about him is because I was the department chair at the University of Texas at El Paso, and Ruben Salazar had done his undergraduate degree at UTEP back when it was called something else. I think he graduated in like 1950. So, just these little encounters with something that I find interesting. Sometimes it's a personal experience. Sometimes it's just, Ruben Salazar went to UTEP. And I'm like, oh yeah, somebody should be writing about him. And then where does it go from there? Well, then it becomes more, how do we think about it in a more systematic way? How do we think about it on a more broad scale kind of way so that it's not just me talking about my own personal experiences?
And does everything come back at some level, or at least involve rhetoric when you're doing this research, or does that vary with the project?
Mostly, I would say, but some of it does feel a little bit more social scientific, and by that I mean like I'll interview people or engage in a lot of field work methods. I think there is this push in rhetorical studies to do more field work, and I think the value in that is that when you're just looking at a text or you're just looking at an archive, you're not necessarily getting the full context. And having the actual experience of meeting people or seeing things firsthand is really beneficial to understanding the context behind maybe, say, the text that you want to analyze.
Well, thank you so much, Profess. Now, are there things you'd like to add to what we've chatted about?
I guess I would just say that to go back to that concept of joy, that I think it's really important that we keep fighting the good fights. There's a lot of them out there. And if we can find ways to have hope that things can change, it's really important, especially when we're thinking about how much the world can change in just a few years, or the kinds of people who get elected, the kinds of wars that have been started in the past couple of years. And so, but I think that the way that we do that is in working with other people in community, in collaboration, and through connection. And so I really want to emphasize those points because they're what keep me going.
Lovely. Thank you so much. It's an optimistic note on which to conclude. I really appreciate the time we've spent together. Thank you so much.
That was fun.